Here they are. We get our first opportunity to talk to them. The new tag team on the block of Smoky Mountain Wrestling. Impressive they are, the Gangstas. New Jack.
Let me tell you something. 30 years ago, we would have been strung up in somebody's tree, getting hung for beating two white boys the way we just did. But now, you might want to come out here and put some belts on us, but the only belts we're going to be wearing around here is the tag team belt. Let me tell you something. I don't like being up here. I was getting out of my car. I slipped and fell. It's a tobacco spit. And you know what I'm saying? Nothing but rednecks up here. Nothing but geese up here. Nothing but coal miners up here. Chicken farmers, Klansmen. I don't like nobody but my partner. You understand? I don't care who you line up in front of me. I'm going to show you how bad New Jack and Mustafa is. You want to talk about violence? Violence to you might be putting somebody in the figure four. Violence to me is taking a can of gas and pouring it on you and setting you on fire. Like me or not, I didn't come up here to be liked. I came up here to get paid. And whoever you put in front of me, I'm going to drop you down.
Care.
I like to send a special shout out to my homeboy, OJ Simpson. Keep up the good work, baby. Two less we got to worry about. You understand? Keep up the good work.
It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered! I'm home!
You're like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh my God, we're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
God, this dialogue is shit.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and fight me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster? Who are you to doubt El Dandy?
Woo!
Welcome to episode 704 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, May 16th, 2021. I am the Solo Monster. Oh, New Jack. Complicated New Jack. We have to talk about New Jack, unfortunately. Some sad news this week. Of course, WrestleMania Backlash is tonight. I'm going to do predictions a little bit later after I talk about Raw and SmackDown stuff from this past week. There's some rumors. Not good rumors going around about the AEW EVP, some drama potentially going on behind the scenes and the impact it could be having on a high-profile free agent who perhaps has resisted signing with AEW because of it. We're going to get into all that. We got about a week left, though, if you want to take advantage of the free 3 months of Get Amazon Music. Time is running out, May 24th. Is the deadline. Use our link, getamazonmusic.com/solomonster, and you can try out Amazon Music free for 3 months. 90 days free of the service. You help out the podcast when you do so. getamazonmusic.com/solomonster. And if you want to make a PayPal donation, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the PayPal button on the right-hand side of the page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. $30, of course, if you want to send some information on over to me. If you have something you'd like to promote or plug that's important to you, just drop me a note and we'll talk about it. Got to say thank you to the Angel of Anarchy, Lucas Kroll. Lucas, that is an amazing gesture. I thank you, sir. The Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, Night Stalker Nayef Al-Safar, John Loose Cannon Lopez, Big Bear Brian Becerra, Killshot Keith Hart, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eicher, The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, Ostentatious Alan Carter, The Wichita Workhorse, Clayton Nettleton, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, Sherrod Big Daddy Boyd, The Pastor of Pain, Domanian UL, The Elite, Edward Vary, Mike Richman Rizzo, Big Homie, Jonathan Burton, Happy Birthday Jad, who turned 31 yesterday, and a barman, Chuck O'Donnell. Listen to his show, Chuck's Cantina, hosted by the barman himself, where anything and everything is up for discussion. Grab a beverage and listen as Chuck has weekly guests on the show covering entertainment, sports, and life. You can hear his recent discussions on the NFL draft, their slurp reviews on the biggest films, and any other BS that happens to come up, including a little pipe bomb by Chuck himself regarding the status of how Warner Brothers is running the DCEU. which drops today. Listen to Chuck's Cantina on Spotify, iHeartRadio, iTunes, and Google Podcasts, or you can ask Alexa to play the show. And I'm not talking about Bliss, although if she hears this, she should listen too. For more information, follow at Chuck's Cantina on Facebook and on Twitter. Now, I mentioned WrestleMania Backlash is tonight on Peacock. God, that sounds so dumb. How about Backlash is tonight on Wolf? Tonight on Ostrich? Tonight on Blobfish? Yes, that is a real thing. The Mighty Blobfish. I would watch Backlash on Blobfish. Unfortunately, the Mighty Blobfish is not eligible to enter the WrestleRumble.com Backlash Pick'em Contest. But if you are listening to this, then you are. Cutoff time for entries is 7 p.m. Eastern tonight. Some of the prop questions include, how will the Raw Women's title match end, pinfall or submission? Which wrestler will suffer the pinfall or submission loss in the WWE Championship match? Will any other wrestlers enter the ring during the Roman Reigns-Cesaro match? You know how these pick'ems work. And if you win, you could wake up Monday morning $1,000 richer. Go to WrestleRumble.com to enter. It costs a lot less than $1,000 to enter. The first, second, and third place winners will be announced on Monday. Go to WrestleRumble.com right now. And I'll save my predictions for after the Raw and SmackDown recaps. First, though, we got some sad news on Friday. One of the most controversial names in wrestling history, and that is no exaggeration, New Jack, passed away on Friday from a heart attack at the age of 58. I just watched his virtual signing for High Spots on their Facebook page like a week ago. They started doing these every week, these virtual signings during the pandemic. So sometimes I'll see that they're live and I'll watch for a little bit. And there was New Jack. He was signing copies of his book and photos and trading cards and turnbuckle pads. And the owner, you know, who's sitting next to him at this table is telling him bad jokes that the fans submitted to try to get him to laugh. They were trying to get him to crack. And he wasn't laughing because they were pretty bad. I mean, these jokes were horrendous. But he got him on the last one. He said, what did one butt cheek say to the other? Together, we could stop this crap. And New Jack cracked up at that one. WWE actually put out a statement about his passing, which shocked me. Talking about his career from the USWA to Smoky Mountain to ECW. Not only did they put a statement out on their website, you know, for a guy who never even worked for them, they gave, and when you consider his past on top of that, they gave Paul Heyman a few minutes at the end of Talking Smack yesterday to say a few words about New Jack. And he was all choked up, called him the original gangsta. New Jack despised Paul Heyman, hated him with a passion, said that he hoped he died slow. So hearing Heyman be the one to eulogize him was something else. I'm sure New Jack would have had a few words about that. But New Jack's legacy is complicated, right? You cannot ignore all of the bad shit that he did just because he's dead now. He took liberties with people in a business where you're supposed to be able to trust your opponent. But you also can't deny the fact that he was charismatic and he could be very entertaining. He was real. He was as real as real gets. That could be a good thing in an industry that increasingly feels less and less real, less and less genuine. I mean, think about what we see on television now from one week to the next, and I'm not just talking WWE. How many people can you pick out? You could probably count them on one hand and still have fingers left over. People that when you watch them on television and you hear them cut a promo, come across to you the way that New Jack came across to people in terms of feeling genuine. That you would look at the guy and say, yep, that's pretty much who he is. I bet when the camera goes off, that's probably pretty much how that person is. Like him or not, for better or worse. The guy was the genuine article. But that could also be a very bad thing. New Jack was not somebody to fuck with. Some of the things he did in the ring, he should have gone to jail for. And he almost did. But I remember saying, you know, when his Dark Side of the Ring episode came out and I did that whole review on it, he was way more intelligent than people give him credit for. As batshit crazy as he was not a dumb person. But when you're a child and you watch your father stab your mother 5 times right in front of you, and then another time when she tries to leave the house, your father shoots her in the leg as she tries to leave, you're going to end up being at least a little bit fucked in the head. There's no way around it. He was supposedly a bounty hunter with 2 murders to his name before he even got into pro wrestling. He and his partner Mustafa, they were the gangsters, got a ton of heat in Smoky Mountain Wrestling for exactly the reasons that you would expect. Given where they were working, he knew how to bring out the worst in those fans. When you think of New Jack, you can't not think of the mass transit incident, one of the more infamous incidents in wrestling history. Mass transit is what they called this kid, Eric Kulas. The kid was 17. He claimed he was 21 when he showed up to work an ECW show. Unfortunately for him, he ended up working a tag match against New Jack, who found him in the back to be very disrespectful when he introduced himself and he was asking if he could get some offense in and, you know, could you give me some color during the match? And his quote in the Dark Side special was, "I didn't want to kill him, but I wanted him close to death." He cut this kid's head open so deep, it very nearly became a crime scene. It looked like one. And the blood-curdling screams, his father, the kid's father at ringside, he's only 17. I mean, that's haunting shit. Whether or not you think the kid was in the right or the wrong, that's almost not even the point. That whole, everything about that was just completely disturbing. I just talked about the JYD story in the history segment on last week's podcast, which I have to say, to listen to New Jack tell it in his own words, the man was a great storyteller. I did enjoy watching my fair share of New Jack shoot interviews when I'd go down the shoot interview rabbit hole. I've said before, Kevin Nash and probably New Jack are two of my more favorite shoot interview subjects when it pops up in my recommendeds on YouTube. More often than not, I will click on it to listen to them tell stories. It's very entertaining. Paul Heyman begging New Jack not to beat up Junkyard Dog at the ECW Wrestlepalooza show because he still owed $300 to New Jack for some weed that he sold him months or years earlier, whatever it was. And New Jack said, "He's gonna pay me back." So he clocked him backstage when he saw him. He never did get his money. JYD died a month later. I know New Jack was still bitter about that. Then there's the Vic Grimes stuff. The two did a balcony dive spot in ECW once. Might have been their Living Dangerously show. Where Grimes got cold feet at the last second, didn't want to do it. And they were already up there. And New Jack said, "Fuck it, we're going." And off they go. And on the way down, Grimes, who was not a small man, landed right on New Jack's head, which cracked his skull. It made him blind in one eye. New Jack claimed he was blind in one eye for the rest of his life. Fast forward a couple of years later, in XPW, which is getting the Dark Side of the Ring treatment later this season, they're booked against each other in a scaffold match. And Grimes comes up to him in the back before the match to apologize for what happened at the ECW show, you know, 2 years earlier. New Jack wasn't having it. He wasn't having any of it. He said Grimes never once called to check on him after what happened. So they're up on the scaffold and he pulls out a taser. New Jack does. And he tases Grimes. Grimes tells him, "Jack, I can't feel my legs." And New Jack goes, "You..." This is, I shouldn't laugh because this is one of the scariest things I've ever seen. But again, when I say he's a character, he's a character. And this is quite the quote. He just looks at Grimes and goes, "You won't need him." Bombs away. And he proceeds to throw Vic Grimes off the scaffold, very nearly to his death. To this day, it is the scariest bump that I have ever seen. I have no idea how Vic Grimes is alive today. Absolutely terrifying. He only missed hitting the floor by about a foot. So again, if you've seen the video, you know what I'm talking about. There were stacks of tables, I think, down below. But the way he threw him, Grimes got tangled up in the ropes. It looked like the ropes were really what broke his fall. If he had just gone straight down to the ground, then he would not be alive. And New Jack was upset because he wanted him to miss the ring and hit the floor. That is what he wanted. And after the match was over, New Jack told Grimes, now we're even. The Gypsy Joe incident, that's another infamous one that there's just no excuse for. And again, if you're going to tell New Jack's story, you have to be fair about it and take the good with the bad. This was very bad. Gypsy Joe was 73 years old at the time. This was at an independent show in 2003. And Joe's whole gimmick was that he's an old man who doesn't feel pain, and he just no-sells everything. And he may have made comments before the match about teaching New Jack a thing or two about wrestling a hardcore match. Well, that didn't sit well with New Jack, who starts beating the crap out of him with a barbed wire baseball bat. What he should have done is take that barbed wire bat to that fucking mutant in the audience who kept chanting, beat that N-word's ass at him. If you're going to yell the N-word at New Jack or anyone else for that matter, you deserve to have your brains beaten in. But Gypsy Joe was not very happy about it. He kept a knife in his bag from that point on, hoping that New Jack would be booked on the same show with him again, which thankfully he never was. But New Jack spent time in TNA. He spent time in CZW. Not a lot of time, but he was there and obviously worked for tons of independent promotions over the years. I think his last match was actually this year, I believe. I think he may have wrestled over WrestleMania weekend in a tag team match. I believe is in one of the eulogies is what I... Because I was wondering, when was the last time he actually wrestled? Has he wrestled, you know, during the pandemic? And apparently he did no more than maybe a month or two ago. But New Jack never worked for WWE. Not even for those one-night stand reunion shows. They brought almost everybody back. At least the ones that were still alive. But not New Jack. He claimed that he and Mustafa were scheduled to appear on one of the shows where ECW invaded WWE. It may have been the one they did at the Manhattan Center. But they got pulled. And Heyman told them they got pulled because Vince McMahon said he didn't trust him to work with his guys. The only time he even came close to working for WWE, he got booked for a tryout match. And this may have been back in 2005, I think. I'm not sure exactly on the year, but he got booked for a tryout match. It ended up not happening. On his podcast, his very short-lived podcast, New Jack's Safe Space, he said that Dean Malenko told him, you know, because Malenko at the time was an agent for WWE. He said Dean Malenko came over to him and said, Jack, whatever you do, don't speak to Vince McMahon. If you pass him in the hallway, just keep walking. Don't say anything. So, of course, New Jack passes him in the hallway and he says, hey, Vince, how you doing? I'm New Jack. Thanks for the opportunity. And Vince McMahon is like, oh, no problem. You're welcome. Good luck. So then after that, he's thinking, who is that fucking guy who told me not to talk to Vince McMahon? He's going off on Dean Malenko. But later on, he's going over his match with the kid that he was working with, and here's all the stuff we're going to do in the match. The guy's totally on board with it. He said the agent for the match was Arn Anderson. And actually, Arn Anderson and Dean Malenko now are working as agents for AEW, but they were both with WWE at that time. And according to New Jack, I guess it would have been Arn Anderson who went to Vince McMahon and told him about all of the stuff that he overheard that New Jack said he was going to do in his match. And later on, when New Jack walked past the board backstage, he noticed that his name, which was on there previously, had been wiped off. So he went up to Arn and he said, why was my name wiped off the fucking board? And Arn Anderson tells him, whatever, you know, something changed. Go get your money from Pat Patterson and we'll be in touch. So, at least they paid him. He was happy that he at least got his payday that he was promised. He said he went to a seafood bar, went to his hotel, got some sleep, and then he flew back to Atlanta. And so ended New Jack's one and only experience with WWE. Now, there were rumors years ago that the original plan was for New Jack to be revealed as the man who stabbed John Cena instead of Carlito's bodyguard. Remember Jesus? They brought in Aaron Aguilera as his bodyguard who stabbed Cena at a club or something. That was the storyline. That's when Cena was feuding with Carlito for the U.S. title. I don't think there was anything to that. I've never heard New Jack confirm that. I've never heard anybody confirm that. Although, it would have been completely believable that New Jack would stab John Cena. I actually think that could have worked. But New Jack is one of those guys where I think he just would have imploded had he gone to WWE. I mean, look at someone like Sandman. Sandman was there for a little while, but, you know, even Sandman didn't last long. Sabu didn't last long. New Jack was on a whole other level. Do you honestly believe that New Jack would have lasted more than a month or two in WWE? It never would have worked. It never would have worked. Certainly not in the PG era. Never would have worked. It's just not a good fit. But in a business full of characters, New Jack was definitely a character. And I think it is appropriate to remember the final parting scene from his Dark Side of the Ring episode when the producer asked him, "How do you think a movie based on your life should end?" He starts laughing hysterically and he says, "It should be him sitting in a wheelchair, snorting coke, getting high as shit, flipping everybody off, saying, 'Thank you, bitches.'" That sounds about right. AEW will beat WWE to the punch this July, taking Dynamite back on the road for the first time since the start of the pandemic. Each event will be held in compliance with state COVID safety guidelines, and seating capacities will be limited to whatever the local mandates may be. So even though they are going back on the road, that does not necessarily mean that every building is going to be packed. I mean, every building may not be packed anyway. We still don't know how many tickets they'll be able to sell. But they are running Florida and Texas for the first three shows. So I doubt there's going to be many restrictions anyway. Wednesday, July 7th at the James L. Knight Center in Miami. July 14th at the HEB Center in Cedar Park, Texas, which is the greater Austin area. And July 21st at the Curtis Culwell Center in Garland, Texas, which is in the greater Dallas area. Per the Observer, they are expected very shortly to announce additional dates for August, September, and October in Rochester, New York, Houston, Milwaukee, Boston, Newark, and Philadelphia. I said this Wednesday night on the stream. If they knew they were heading back on the road so soon, I don't know when the final decision on this was made. I assume it wasn't last minute. But if they had any sense that they were heading back on the road so soon, I don't know why they didn't just do a stadium stampede match with the Inner Circle and the Pinnacle at the pay-per-view in a few weeks to then build to a Blood and Guts rematch on the road in one of these buildings. Unless the buildings are just too small to accommodate two rings, these are smaller venues that they're going to be running. These are buildings that can fit 3, 4, 5,000 people. These are not big arenas that they're going to be running at first. But they were so close. Why not just wait and do Blood and Guts in front of more people than you were able to fit in Daly's place? I don't get it. But that show on Wednesday, I said I thought it was a very good show. I thought it was a really fun open with Jon Moxley defending the IWGP United States title against Yuji Nagata. Moxley coming out to Wild Thing as a tribute to Atsushi Onita, the deathmatch legend. I assume it's just a one-time thing. I mean, look, I like the song Wild Thing, but I like Moxley's AEW music just fine. I don't think he needs to be coming out to that every week. SCU is, of course, Moxley won. SCU is no more after their loss to the Young Bucks, which now sets up Moxley and Eddie Kingston to challenge for the tag team titles at Double or Nothing. Orange Cassidy is fine after a scare on Dynamite. It looked like he got his bell rung. And the referees and the doctors were checking on him in the middle of his match with Pac, which went to a no contest, basically. So it'll be Orange Cassidy and Pac both challenging Kenny Omega in a triple threat for the AEW World title on May 30th. Darby Allin lost the TNT Championship to Miro, who now looks to be set up to defend that title against Lance Archer very soon, possibly at Double or Nothing. And I think Darby Allin and Miro both, but I think Darby deserves a lot of credit. I thought that main event was very good on Wednesday. Darby is just very, very good at selling, you know, a beating. It helps that he's a smaller guy. Miro was throwing him around. I got an email from somebody asking me who I think is the better seller in wrestling history, Bret Hart or Darby Allin? And I laughed. But I understand why you know somebody might send that question in to me. Darby is a very good seller. He is not on the level of a Bret Hart. Darby is still very young in his career. You know, ask me that question in 10 years. Maybe I'll give you a different answer. I mean, Bret Hart is in another category as far as selling a believable beating in wrestling. But Darby is very good, and I thought that they pulled off a very good match. You know, the little fist bump he shared with Sting right before he got beat at ringside. So I enjoyed that. I enjoyed that main event. But the bigger story that has been going around, and this is not a story that has been going around for a few days. This is a story that has been going around for actually many months. And I have not commented on it previously because it was, and it still is, just a rumor. There is really nothing to base this on in fact. But as it is being talked about more and more, and you point to some of the little signs that are out there, I do believe that there is smoke to the fire. But we still have to just understand that this is all, at this point, just a rumor. But what kicked all of this off this week, I guess on a recent Jim Cornette Experience podcast, his co-host Brian Last had made comments to the effect of hearing stories from unnamed sources, I guess, about angry messages and emails that have gone back and forth between some of the EVPs in AEW, that being Cody and Kenny Omega and the Young Bucks. Again, not the first time I've heard this. But when you hear, oh, it's the Jim Cornette's podcast, and even though that wasn't coming from Cornette himself, who isn't admitted, I mean, he does not like any of those people. We know that, right? We know he does not like the Bucks. We know he does not like Kenny Omega. He used to like Cody. I don't know if he likes him anymore. But it came from his co-host, and I don't know what his stance is one way or the other on AEW. But I guess on one of the Fightful podcasts, Sean Ross Sapp chimed in, said that he heard the same rumors, and it was worth asking about. The people who were talking about this, you know, according to him, are not the people from within AEW. There are other people who have been talking about this. And then over on the Torch website, Wade Keller and Jason Powell of ProWrestling.net, were doing a show, and they were talking about the subject. And they made some comments, and I'll just, you know, read them to you real quick here. Wade Keller, this is what he had to say. There's going to be a book written someday by some of these EVPs or somebody else closely observing, and we're going to learn about a lot of dysfunction. We're going to learn what a very short honeymoon period there was between certain key people in the company who aren't even talking to each other anymore. I think we're going to find that out. I know that there are people in other wrestling companies saying the Bucks and Cody and Kenny, it's not going to be long at all before they want to have nothing to do with each other. The honeymoon period is going to be short. It seems like it is. It seems like there's some disengagement and people going off into their own that is showing up in certain ways. And then Powell chimed in. And I guess this is why it became news this week, because he added a little something to it. He says, if this isn't happening, then they need to clear up that misconception. I do think it's happening. There's a would-be difference maker who could go there that has that opinion that there is all of this infighting, and this person, for that reason, is very hesitant to go there. So that's why this became news this week, because what he's saying is that there is a big wrestling name, He didn't say who it is. And the main reason that they have not yet signed with AEW is because they believe that there is a lot of dysfunction between the EVPs and a lot of politicking or whatever going on behind the scenes, and they just don't feel very comfortable about it. Now, you know, when he makes the comment that, look, if none of this is true, they need to clear up that misconception. So what you're asking them to do is basically, you know, make a comment about, let's just say that none of this is true, you know, make a joint comment about an unfounded rumor. I mean, I don't know that they have to come out and do that. But, you know, you look at some of the evidence, right? A lot of people point to the fact that Cody stopped being on the Being the Elite show, the Young Bucks Being the Elite show on YouTube a long time ago. He used to be on it a lot. Now I guess he's not on it at all. Cody was asked about that in an interview last year with PW Insider. And he described it as being a scheduling issue. But he also admitted that there have been disagreements between them. This is what he said. He says, I'm never on BTE anymore. BTE has become a spotlight for younger guys and girls, and I totally get that. But I have nothing but respect and love for Matt and Nick and Kenny. And if you ever hear about any infighting or any things of that nature, sure, I'm sure there's arguments and I'm sure there's differences of opinion. But we have never gone into a show where we weren't all on the same page, very professional. Those guys all put the professional in professional wrestler. And, you know, we don't spend near as much time together anymore, but we have this show with our faces on it, and I know we want to make it the best. So that's, you know, that's a very telling statement in itself. You know, him basically saying, yeah, sure, there's disagreements and there may be arguments, but look, when the camera goes on and we go live on TNT, everything is fine. So you hear comments like that, and yeah, I think there probably is smoke to the fire. Not only is Cody never on Being the Elite, but apparently he finds time to appear on Sammy Guevara's vlog. So is it really a scheduling issue? I'm not so sure. If you watch AEW Dynamite, you can just tell they're all doing their own thing. Now, Kenny and the Bucks are aligned together on television now that the Bucks have gone heel. Cody is off doing, he's like off in his own universe. Half the time, I don't know what the fuck is going on with Cody. You look at the year that Cody has had, it's just bizarre. So clearly Cody is doing his own thing. Has absolutely nothing to do with the Bucks, has absolutely nothing to do with Omega. In fact, I don't think any of them have even been associated on television with each other since, you know, probably well before the pandemic. Maybe the last time I even remember seeing them in the ring together might have been that first pandemic show, which I think they opened. They were in the ring together in an empty Daily's place, and they wanted to put on this great show of unity, and that might have been it. That might have been the last time. Now, I understand that Cody in storyline can't challenge for the world title, so, but still, that doesn't mean that, yeah, you can't associate them on TV. It is very bizarre. Cody seems to be more focused. Well, Cody's focused on a whole bunch of different things. Obviously, he's about to have a kid. He left for a while. He was doing that Go Big show on TBS, which is why Brody Lee got the TNT title last year, because Cody was going to be gone for about a month filming for the show. But, you know, Cody is doing a lot of stuff with the Nightmare Factory. That's kind of his thing, and I'm sure he really wants to push some of those faces from the Nightmare Factory, and I wonder if any of that has something to do with what may possibly be going on here, where he's got his people that he wants to focus on and push, and maybe that differs, maybe, right, from the people that Omega and the Bucks. I mean, I don't know if the Bucks are pushing specific people. Obviously, they have their, you know, some of their friends are working for the company. Brandon Cutler is employed because he's friends with the Young Bucks. Kenny, we've heard about him being a big champion for a lot of the Joshi wrestlers, and I'm sure he has his names that he pushes for and advocates for behind the scenes. Maybe there's a difference of opinion there. I don't know. Again, this is all speculation, but yes, you can point to certain things that make you go, something may be going on here. But this is the issue, right? When you put wrestlers who are active performers in the position of authority within the company behind the scenes, and they all have the executive vice president title, I mean, you're just asking for trouble. You're just asking at some point for there to be something that's just going to blow up in your face. And that could be what we're seeing here. I mean, look, they're kind of off doing their own thing. It's doesn't sound to me like it's causing problems elsewhere with the product. Certain things feel a little disjointed. Again, it is very strange how Cody is just sort of off in his own universe doing his own thing. But you don't want that to bleed into the product. That is something that Tony Khan has to be very mindful of going forward. And I don't know, you know, you're not going to demote them. You know, you put them in these positions. And by the way, being in those positions, I'm sure they also get certain benefits that a lot of the other talent do not get because they are in an executive position. So they probably get health benefits. Maybe they have a 401k. They probably have all of that stuff if they're EVPs. So you're not gonna yank the title away from them, but it could be trouble down the road. It is gonna be something to watch. Now, this story about there being a big name who doesn't want to sign with AEW because they're hearing stories about this. My first thought was Punk. It is strange. Punk at least used to be friendly with some of these guys, and they obviously never made anything work. There was texting going on. I know Punk was offended by that. Don't text me stuff. If you want me, call me or meet with me. Punk was the first name that popped up. Obviously, Daniel Bryan's the other name you think of because he's the other big free agent at the moment. Maybe Bryan has heard things and he's a little hesitant, but right now this is all just speculation. But this is chatter that's becoming louder and louder. At some point, it becomes a distraction for the company where maybe they do have to come out and make some kind of a joint statement. Maybe they have to start appearing on television together to shut people up and say, hey, look at us, we're working together. But if you have people in an EVP role who are not on speaking terms, who are not even communicating with each other anymore, that's going to become a problem. And that's something that if I'm Tony Khan, if this really is going on, I try to get everybody in a room backstage at Dynamite one week, and I try to nip this in the bud before it turns into something that you don't want it to turn into. And if it's having an effect on people who don't want to sign with the company, then you've got a real problem. With AEW announcing a return to the road, the Matt Men podcast is now reporting that WWE is looking to do the same, starting as soon as the July 16th episode of SmackDown. I believe there may be a pay-per-view that weekend, though, so maybe they would hold off for that, but it sounds like it's coming soon. And you knew that if AEW was going back on the road, WWE would not be far behind. When you hear people associated with WWE or from WWE saying, oh, we don't pay any attention to what AEW does, we don't let them dictate how we do our business. Bullshit. Bullshit. You know that it's got to burn them that AEW is going to be able to go out there and claim that we're the first major wrestling promotion to be back on the road in front of crowds. All of a sudden, here comes the news that WWE may be doing the same within a few weeks, within a week or so after AEW hits the road. That is not a coincidence. Now, 6 months ago, Vince McMahon fired Zelina Vega for breach of contract over her refusal to shut down her third-party endeavors with websites like Twitch and OnlyFans. They put that policy in place, and they gave talent about 30 days to discontinue them or surrender their logins to the company. And she resisted doing so, and she found out that she was shit-canned when she got to the building for SmackDown, and Vince McMahon would not even take a meeting with her to discuss things when she asked to speak with him. He wouldn't even meet with her. That then led to her, the same day after she got the news, putting a tweet out endorsing the idea of unions and unionization. And later on, she spoke with the Screen Actors Guild, which claimed, oh, we're very interested in assisting professional wrestlers. In fact, this is what the SAG-AFTRA president, Gabrielle Carteris, had to say at that time about all of this. She said, wrestling is as much about media as it is sports. And we are going to directly engage with members of this profession to help find ways for them to protect themselves. As more people reinvest in unions and as more working people are harassed by employers who don't want to protect them, SAG-AFTRA is committed to doing what we can to help professional wrestlers secure the protections they deserve. Oh, yeah. It also led to Andrew Yang taking an interest in the story and speaking out about, you know, if he was either going to be the Secretary of Labor under Biden, or if he wasn't, he would know who the person was. He would have their ear about the independent contractor classification nonsense for all of Vince McMahon's talent. And it's not just Vince McMahon. I mean, obviously, they're classified as independent contractors in other promotions as well. But he was so vocal about this on Twitter. He even went on some wrestling podcasts. I think he talked to Chris Van Vliet and he talked to some other wrestling websites because he's a wrestling fan. He's talking about Macho Man against Ricky Steamboat at WrestleMania 3. That's great. That's great. He's a wrestling fan. Congratulations. So am I. But he's out there at the time. Oh, I haven't forgotten about you, Vince McMahon. Right? All of this bluster from these people. Here we are 6 months later. Not only has nothing happened, and they haven't even been tweeting. Oh, they were tweeting about it all the time back then. They don't even tweet about it anymore. Not only that, this week we learned per Fightful.com that Zelina Vega was spotted at the WWE Performance Center on Thursday. And according to Wrestling Inc., there have been plans for her return to television dating back even before WrestleMania. So while no official announcement has been made, I cannot sit here and say that Zelina Vega is back or coming back for sure to WWE. Boy, it sure does look that way. She was apparently at the PC this week filming stuff with Simone Johnson, the daughter of The Rock, who has been training at the PC going back to last year. The two of them are very good friends. Simone has had issues with her knees popping out of place. She had her third knee surgery in September. She's only 19 years old. She's had three knee surgeries already. Now, what they were filming for is not known. I saw a lot of derogatory comments online about Vega for going back to WWE after all of the unionization talk, how she could have led the charge and instead she sold her soul. And I applauded her back in November when this all went down for taking a stand for what she believes in. She was very passionate about having the ability to, you know, make money on these platforms and very passionate about her Twitch, which somebody told me, I don't even think she's been active on Twitch now for over a month. Is that true? Because if that's the case, that probably should have been a sign right there. But at the time, I had a lot of respect for her taking the stance that she did. But money talks. I said as much when I talked about it on Sound Off 678. I said a few things. There will never be a pro wrestling union. It's just not going to happen. You need strength in numbers for something like that, and you will never, ever have the numbers or the names that you need to really make a change. When Zelina Vega got fired, did anybody else in the company stand up and say anything? Nope. Paige, I guess you could say Paige was vocal about it. I guess she must have worked out her issues with the company because she's still under contract with them and she's on Twitch. I don't know what happened there. But Paige is not active. Paige used to be a big name for a while on the main roster. She was very popular, and she still is, but she's not actively on the roster. Who else in that company who's active on the roster with a big name or even a middle-of-the-road kind of big name stood up and came to her defense or stood up and was vocal about this issue? Because we saw report after report after report from all these different websites. Oh, the talent in WWE, they're so upset about that. Not just about what happened to Zelina, but about this whole edict that Vince McMahon passed along. They're very upset. There's a lot of anger behind the scenes and a lot of confusion from the talent in the company, and people are really upset about this. How many people stood up publicly and said anything? None. None of them did. That's my point. So when you think about change, how do you affect change in a situation like that? You do it through strength in numbers. And if you can throw one or two really big names in there along with everybody else, boy, would that help out a lot. You've never seen it because it's never going to happen. Because everybody in that company is at least happy enough with what they're making or with their spot on the card. And they don't want to rock the boat. And maybe they're worried about the same thing, that if I say something, boy, I sure would love to. And maybe a few other people told me, hey, if you do it first, I'll do it too. But nobody believes, nobody trusts that if they are vocal about it, that there's going to be enough people who are vocal with them. And they don't want to be the only person who stands up and raises their hand, because then they get fucked. And everybody else just kind of sits there and stays quiet. So you can kind of understand why. WWE has something that no other promotion has, with the exception, I guess, of AEW, because it's also owned by a billionaire. Although he's a billionaire on a budget, he claims. What does WWE have lots of? Money. Even without the live crowds now for over a year, okay, forget WrestleMania. They've gone a year plus without live crowds for their weekly shows. Even without that, which used to be the lifeblood of the company. It used to be about the gate. It used to be about ticket sales. It's not about that anymore. Even without that, they're making more money than ever before in the history of the company. Zelina Vega alone was never going to create the change that people envisioned. I still don't have a good answer as to why pro wrestlers cannot join the SAG union if they wanted to. But nothing has happened in these 6 months. People forget. It's on to the next news cycle. And in the end, they always end up back with Vince. So I don't begrudge the woman for trying to make a living. But isn't it a weird coincidence that the same week we learn of Zelina Vega's potential impending WWE return, PW Insider announces that the company has shut down its new talent management group, which I guess was a Nick Khan idea, where WWE would basically have an entire department in-house to manage these third-party bookings and sponsorships for the talent so that they can have control over it and take their cut. It existed for all of a month and has already been disbanded. It has already been shut down. No reason yet as to why. Nick Khan learning very fast that plans change in the world of Vince McMahon. And I wasn't even going to address this because you have to consider the source on these things. There was a report going around that the reason we have not seen Bray Wyatt on WWE television is because he has been out dealing with mental health issues tied into the death of his good friend Brody Lee, the former Luke Harper. And this also may have been why he lost his match with Randy Orton at WrestleMania. He requested time off because of his issues, and so they had him lose and they took him off TV. Given where this originated, I was skeptical the moment I read it. Fightful on their Patreon said that WWE talent were not aware of Wyatt having any personal issues. Quite the opposite, in fact. He's been seen backstage at a few Raw since WrestleMania, and he seemed fine, and those around him have said that he really wants to be back on television. But they have not heard of any specific reason why he has been off TV. This is one of those stories, you know, given the nature of the news that's being shared, you're talking about somebody having mental health problems. You really need to be careful with something like this. And I say, always consider the source with these things. So until we get something more concrete on this, as far as I'm concerned, this is a non-story. But I had to bring it up because people were asking if I were going to talk about it, and it kind of blew up. And so anyway, that's my thoughts on that. Now, before we get into Raw and SmackDown and Backlash, I did watch the Booker T A&E documentary last weekend. And I think that I thought it was very good. And I thought the first hour or so of the documentary was probably the more powerful of the two. In fact, I know it was the more powerful of the two because it focused more on his upbringing and all of the struggles that he went through. And I've heard him tell the story before about his mother. You know, it was him and his siblings, and his mother was up in the attic, and she had fallen and she suffered a back injury, and she underwent a couple of surgeries. In the second surgery, there were complications and she passed away. And Booker was very young at that time. And so the kids were pretty much on their own. He had no mother. He had no father. It was just him and his older siblings. And they were in a house all by themselves, no other family. And they kept the water on and the lights on as long as possible until they couldn't. And then for a while there was no electricity and there was no water. And things got really bad there for a while. So it's a very compelling story, which of course then leads into talk about his run-in with the law. Now, I had always known that there was a robbery. I don't remember if it was a Wendy's or a McDonald's. I guess it was a Wendy's. I think it was a Wendy's that he actually worked at the time. What I didn't know, and this is actually something new that I had learned, what I didn't know is that it wasn't just that he robbed the Wendy's. Apparently, he and his other, you know, the other people who participated in this with him, they had robbed the same Wendy's well over 20 times before they were finally caught, because they got away with it the first time, and then they got away with it the second, third, fourth, and fifth time, and they just kept doing it. So you're really tempting fate when you do something like that, but when you're that young and stupid, you're not thinking about it in those terms. You're just thinking about it in terms of, hey, we got away with it, let's just do it again, because we need money. Right? Because he was poor, and they needed money. So that's, eventually he got arrested for that. He ended up, serving, you know, a few years in prison. Actually, I think he got paroled. It was a little shy of 2 years. It was a 5-year sentence. He got paroled after about 19 months. And he remembers leaving that day, and one of the prison guards is sitting on horseback, watching him as he's being led out of the prison. And he says, "I'll see you when you get back." You know, implying that in a lot of cases, these people end up right back behind bars. And those were words that really stuck with him, because in his mind, he had no intention of ever going back. So as they told that story, I thought that was some of the more compelling stuff in the documentary. They got into his entry into professional wrestling, which really he credits his brother Stevie Ray with. And Stevie was going to get into pro wrestling as a singles. He and Booker ended up as a tag team almost by accident. It was not his intent for his brother to not only follow him into pro wrestling, but, you know, become tag team partners with him. But that's just sort of how it worked out. And they became a very hot act as a tag team, the Ebony Experience, in Global, down in Texas. And, you know, Booker shared a story, some advice that he got from Ox Baker. It's funny, I was just watching a replay of an old Price is Right episode on Pluto TV, and who should I see as a contestant on The Price is Right who actually got on stage with Bob Barker? It's Ox Baker. I knew right away, because Ox Baker, there's nobody who looks like Ox Baker used to look, with that mustache and the bald head and everything. And he told Bob, "I'm a pro wrestler," and all that. So anyway, I just made me think of that. But Ox Baker is the one who gave Booker the advice and said, "Look, you're going to run into a lot of obstacles in your career." And he didn't outright come out and say that it's going to be racism, but that's kind of what Booker felt he was implying. You're going to run into a lot of obstacles, and you've got to, you know, find a way to overcome them. And that's when the documentary turned to the idea of racism. And a lot of the racism that he and his brother encountered, you know, there were a lot of fans who did not like them. In the audience down there in Texas, they'd be wrestling at the Sportatorium, and they would have racial epithets thrown at them and the N-word thrown at them a lot. Over time, the people ended up warming up to them and really did like them, which he thought was kind of cool, because here these people were saying all these awful things to him before, but as they got to know them, and they kind of became baby faces, all of a sudden they loved him. "Oh, we love Booker. We love Stevie." But they talked about the racial issue. And they even talked about it at the WCW stuff when they had a match with the Steiner Brothers 1 year in Sturgis outdoors at that Hog Wild show, where they had all the motorcycle guys honking their horns. It was, you know, the big gathering at Sturgis. And you can imagine some of the comments that were thrown their way. And I thought, you know, that would be the perfect time, perhaps, to get into another subject while they were touching on the subject of racism. And they didn't do it. And this kind of led to a story this week, because one of the people that was interviewed for this documentary, he's all over the documentary, is this writer and professor by the name of David Dennis Jr., who came out on Twitter this week and said that he was interviewed for the biography, also for the storyline with Booker T and Triple H going into WrestleMania 19 and their world title match back in 2003. And they asked him about it, and he gave them a lot of material on it, and it did not make the documentary. Apparently, it made the cutting room floor. This is what he said. Now, he has since deleted these tweets, but this is what David Dennis had to say. So one of the main reasons I was brought in was to talk about the WrestleMania 19 match. I went in about it for a long time, but my ass knew that it wasn't making the final cut, so I figured I was going to get cut out from the whole documentary. So there's a lot of footage somewhere that is pretty spice, according to what he said in those tweets. Now, Booker T, on his Hall of Fame show with Brad Gilmore, he addressed this. He said that he saw a rough cut of the documentary about a year ago. He goes, that scene about WrestleMania 19 was not in there either. So if it ever was in there, it was cut very early on, but basically saying that it was never in there to begin with. And so in his view, how could it be cut when it wasn't in there in the first place? And he said, look, he doesn't spend much time thinking about it. He got paid more for that one match against Triple H than any match he had done up to that point, and maybe since, at any other point in his career. And I agree, it does not define Booker T's career. I've never, you know, when I've talked about it on my show, I've never implied that it defines his career. And I'm sure he doesn't want that to define his career, because that was not his finest moment as far as the Booker T character is concerned. But the reality is, if you go back and you watch the build-up to the match and the promos with Triple H, if you deny the fact that there was a racial element to it, then you're burying your head in the sand. They were clearly leaning into that, whether it was the comments about, you know, people like you. I think he may have made a nappy hair comment or something. People like you were meant to entertain, dance for me, Booker. Some of the stuff that he was saying, I mean, as a heel, you knew exactly what he was playing off of. And I don't think a single person would have minded if Booker T would have gone to WrestleMania that year and, in the end, gotten the win over Triple H and proved that, you know what, you were wrong. I do belong. And now I'm the world champion. Even if Triple H a month or two later would have ended up winning the belt back. Not only did that not happen, but a lot of the issues that people have with that match and the finish has to do with the way it played out and just how ridiculous it was when you had people, certain, you know, top level people kicking out of big moves. Sometimes it would take two or three of them to get the job done. Not only did Booker T lose after being mocked and made to look foolish on television and made to look less than on television, but it was the idea that Triple H would drop him with one pedigree and then lay there for what felt like about 5 years before he finally crawled over and made the pin. And Booker T never bothered. He never kicked out. He just got pinned 1, 2, 3. It was also the way in which it happened. Absolutely infuriating. So yes, it does not define his career. It is only one match. They only have so much time in these documentaries. But since they brought up the subject, yeah, I think it would have been interesting to include part of that in the documentary, and the fact that there are a lot of fans who were very upset about it. And you know what? Cut to Booker and let Booker in the documentary say exactly what he said here on his radio show. But do I think there was a place for it in there? Apparently the producers thought there was, if they interviewed the guy for it. Now, whether it was their decision and watching it back to say, you know what? We don't really want to get into this. We don't really want to piss off WWE. Let's cut it. Was it WWE chiming in on it? Because look, these documentaries are made in cooperation with WWE. Even if every documentary, as we've been told, has a different set of producers who work on them, so the people who worked on the Macho Man one are not the same ones who may have worked on the Booker T one, and so on and so forth, it is still made in conjunction with WWE. And WWE gives them the footage, WWE gives them a lot of the talking heads that they use for it, and you have to believe that WWE gets a look at it well before it ends up on TV. So if they interviewed the guy and they had footage for it, they did that for a reason. And I would be very curious to know what it was about that footage that they thought, you know what, we don't really want to put that in the documentary. I think that's a perfectly valid question to ask. I think it's great that Booker says it doesn't define his career. He doesn't think about it. He got paid a lot for the match. That's great. As a fan, I would love to know what the decision-making process was if they brought this guy in to talk to him about it, and they covered other aspects of race in this documentary. Why did they not think that that would be an interesting thing to bring up, given the uproar among certain fans over the years about the finish of that match? I don't see anything wrong with that. But it was good. Again, the wrestling stuff, they kind of rushed through it. They just briefly covered some of the key stuff. You know, they covered his world title win over Jeff Jarrett and the Bash at the Beach stuff with Hogan and Vince Russo, and him coming to WWE and hurting Stone Cold on his first night in, the supermarket brawl between them, one of the all-time great segments on SmackDown. The King Booker stuff that came a little bit later on. So, I mean, on the whole, I think it was a good watch. If you were thinking about watching it, I think more so the stuff on his background, that really was the more compelling stuff when you really kind of hear about his life story. And he could have ended up in a really bad place. He was going down that road. I mean, he was behind bars, right? It doesn't get much worse than that, unless you're in the ground, I guess. And that could have been the way he was headed, but you know, he ended up doing pretty good for himself, I would say. Raw on Monday, there was a six-woman tag with Asuka teaming with Dana Brooke and Mandy Rose against Charlotte Flair, Shayna Baszler, and Nia Jax, where Asuka pinned Shayna. And before this, in the middle of the match, Alexa Bliss appeared on her swing set on stage with her puppet friend Lily, who Alexa said had her eye on one of them, but she didn't say who. And then later on, Shayna's knee suddenly gave out on her and she couldn't move, which is what led to Asuka getting the win. So I guess we're supposed to believe that Lily had something to do with it, like some sort of voodoo magic. Like when Chucky snapped that guy's leg in his arm with the voodoo doll in Child's Play, then stabbed the doll in the chest and killed the guy. That wouldn't be very PG, though, if they tried that here. This is all very dumb, and they need to get it out of their system now, because the minute they get back in front of crowds, which could be happening as soon as a couple of months from now, they are going to shit all over this. And I think they are well aware of this, so they're trying to get it all out now. Jinder Mahal, who returned on Main Event the week before with a win over Jeff Hardy, formally returned to the Raw brand for the first match on the show of his in almost a year, flanked by the same two men he had with him on Main Event, his two new associates called Veer and Shanky. I don't know if that's a descriptive term of what happens if you cross him. He would be the guy I might stay away from in the showers in prison. I thought it was the same Indushare team that we saw last year on NXT, but only Veer is from Indushare. The other member was Sarav Gurjar, I believe was his name. He has been replaced by Shanky. And it just so happens that Gurjar is the one who leaked the result of the winner-take-all match last year at the NXT Great American Bash show on Instagram. So whatever heat he was said to have had at the time, it cannot be a coincidence that he was the member they left behind. I believe he is still under contract. Jeff Hardy lost again. Jeff the Jobber, that is his new name. Seems to be the only value they see in him at this point. All those times he tapped out to the Hurt Lock and all the matches he had with Bobby Lashley, now this. I know Jeff isn't what he used to be. He's older now. It's fine for him to lose, to put over a few people, but he still has to win. Otherwise, him losing all the time, it ain't gonna mean much. If he just becomes Jeff the Jobber, then that's gonna lose a lot of whatever value he might have left. So if you beat him, it's like, well, so does everybody else. So what difference does it make? It's just sad. It's sad to watch him used in this way, but he knew what to expect when he re-signed with the company. And as far as Jinder is concerned, they're going to start over with him. The inevitable match with Drew McIntyre is coming. There's history there. But I am about as interested in another Jinder Mahal push as I was the last time we saw it, and I didn't care for it then either. Randy Orton, Matt Riddle, Kofi Kingston, and Xavier Woods picked up a win over AJ Styles, Omos, Elias, and Jackson Ryker when Orton pinned Elias. Orton was not amused with New Day. He laid them both out as well. after the match with RKOs, but he did not give one to Riddle. Instead, he walked off and Riddle said they're never going to make new friends if he keeps doing that. So they're teasing it. They're teasing that he's going to drop this bozo, but he won't do it because they have new merch on the way. It would be too soon. Plus, they haven't won the tag team titles yet, which I think is where this is headed. Has to be. Sonya Deville made a match between Asuka and Rhea Ripley. Even though Asuka already wrestled earlier in the show, this came after a meeting with Charlotte Flair that Deville had, which we couldn't hear. So Rhea thought that it was a little suspect that she would be forced to wrestle Asuka 6 days before their triple threat match at Backlash. But she said that she would beat Asuka again like she did at WrestleMania, and that is exactly what she did. She pinned Asuka clean with the Riptide. And I know a few people I saw were very upset about Asuka being used in this way, Asuka losing. But this is how you create and strengthen new stars, by winning. It was the right outcome. Asuka was largely dominant for the year, and now it's Rhea's turn. Plus, they did give Asuka the win at the beginning of the show. So this did not bother me the way that apparently it bothered some of you. There was a scary moment in the Sheamus-Humberto Carrillo match where Carrillo hit a sunset flip powerbomb out to the floor, and Sheamus landed right on top of him, more on Carrillo's leg, it looked like. Looked like he went stiff for a second. The referee immediately checked on him, then he called the match off. He awarded the win to Sheamus. Carrillo is okay, so that's good. We had a similar situation I mentioned before with Orange Cassidy on Dynamite where it looked like he got his bell rung, but he was said to be okay and chatting with people in the back after it was over. Shelton Benjamin beat Cedric Alexander. One of the last wins Benjamin can probably expect to get on this show. Damian Priest beat John Morrison off yet another miscommunication between Miz and Morrison, which meant Priest could choose the stipulation for his match with Miz at Backlash, and he chose Lumberjack Match, so that Miz has nowhere to run and nowhere to hide. And Drew McIntyre had his match seemingly won against Bobby Lashley after a Claymore kick before Braun Strowman's music hit. He attacked Drew from behind for the DQ. Strowman laid him out with a power slam. Then he put down Lashley with a power slam, then another for Drew, then he power slammed Lashley through the barricade. He gave Drew one more slam in the ring for good measure, keeping him strong before he does the J-O-B tonight. Yeah, the thing about Raw, you can see that they're taking steps on this show, putting the Raw women's title on Rhea Ripley, giving more TV time to guys like Carrillo and Angel Garza, who was also on the show doing some stuff with Drew Gulak. They had a short video package for the Lucha House Party, who may soon be getting another push. They're Lucha Lit. That's apparently going to be their new phrase. They're Lucha Lit. We have these vignettes for Eva Marie. Even if you don't like her, we got two more of those on the show this week. They're reintroducing Jinder Mahal with his new crew. There is evidence that they are trying to push some new faces, or not even necessarily new, but push existing faces that they haven't been doing anything with or that we haven't seen for a while. Rome wasn't built in a day, and they have no goodwill left with me. I can tell you that. As a member of the audience, they have no goodwill. They have squandered all of their goodwill with me. It is a step in the right direction. I'll believe it when I see it, when it comes to them actively trying to get these people over without losing interest in them after a few weeks. And it remains to be seen if these are people the fans even want to see. You know, with the Thunderdome, they don't have to worry about who's over and who's not. They can pipe in cheers and boos as needed. Do the fans want to see another Jinder Mahal push? Do the fans want to see another Eva Marie push? We don't really know the answer to that. You can say no, but you don't know that for a fact. Not everybody in the audience is as bright as you and me. There's some pretty dumb people out there. So we just don't have an answer because we don't have people in the buildings yet. It's going to be very interesting if they do get back on the road in July, and these are the people they're pushing, Jinder Mahal and Eva Marie and Humberto Carrillo. Are these the people that the fans are going to get behind, or are they just going to sit on their hands and shit all over it? We just don't know. Now, over on SmackDown, we had more Samoan family drama this week with Jimmy Uso refusing to play ball with Roman Reigns and fall in line. Jimmy said he doesn't think Roman can beat Cesaro. He has a new shirt, by the way. It says, "Nobody's bitch," which they have now trademarked, that phrase. But Jimmy said he doesn't think Roman can beat Cesaro, and that if he and Jay can win the tag team titles, they'll be the Tribal Chiefs, which infuriated Roman Reigns. He said, "You can't do what I do," which led to Jimmy challenging Cesaro to a match, Jimmy's first match in over a year. Natalya and Tamina, they are the new women's tag team champions, beating Nia Jax and Shayna Baszler. Rough match. Definitely a rough match, but, you know, it was a nice moment for Tamina at the end. You can see it meant a lot to her, and they were interviewed in the ring after. Natty cried, of course, and Tamina was emotional. They shot off pyro to try to make this feel like a big moment. They tried. I'm happy they got their moment, but I'm happier to see an end to this feud and an end to the reign of Jax and Baszler. Shayna needs to get as far away from Nia as possible. But for some reason, they give Nia Jax tons of television time. It is absolutely mind-boggling to me. So splitting away from Nia could actually mean less airtime for Shayna. But I don't care. Just get them away from each other, please. Enough. Apollo Crews was hosting a Medal of Honor ceremony for his boy, Commander Aziz, for all of his sacrifices in recent weeks, fighting off all of the men that have come after Apollo's Intercontinental title. He was interrupted by Big E, Sami Zayn, Kevin Owens. A huge brawl broke out. This now leads to a fatal four-way for the championship on SmackDown this Friday. Keep that thing on Apollo. He's got a good thing going right now. Rey Mysterio picked up a win over Dolph Ziggler ahead of their tag team title match tonight. You know, these two have been around in this company for ever and ever and ever. One-on-one like this, I just could not bring myself to care. I really like Rey and Dom as a team. But you put Rey Mysterio one-on-one in the ring with Dolph Ziggler, and I don't give a shit. I just don't care. King Cockroach got a pinfall win over Shinsuke Nakamura. They kept repeating over and over again that it was the King of the Ring taking on the King of Strong Style. They said it so many times that I would think there's got to be a reason for it, and that reason could very well be a return of the King of the Ring tournament. Get rid of the extreme rules nonsense and bring back King of the Ring. Maybe King of the Ring will be the first pay-per-view on the road if they do it in July. After the match, Nakamura gave Corbin the Kinshasa, stole his crown. So it could just be a really terrible storyline where Nakamura stole his crown and they fight over it, like that time that Jean-Pierre Lafitte stole Bret Hart's leather jacket and they had a pay-per-view match over it and Bret got his jacket back. Or that one time on Monday Night Raw back in the early days where Repo Man stole Macho Man's hat. But that was, I think that was only a one-night storyline, though, and they had a match and it was over, right? They didn't drag it out for weeks. So I could be wrong. Maybe I'm just reading too much into this and the King of the Ring is not coming back, but I would certainly bring it back. Because if nothing else, the King of the Ring is a great way to give some more meaning to meaningless television matches. Whether it's qualifying matches, whether you do the first round on TV. See, I'm a big fan of the way they did it at the beginning in 93 and 94, where they had the entire main part of the tournament, first round to finals, on the pay-per-view. So that, you know, assuming that nobody went to a draw, you could have up to 8 matches on one show. But they don't do it that way anymore. Or if they did bring the pay-per-view back, it would probably just be the semifinals and the finals. But I have a soft spot for the King of the Ring. If it's done right, I would be a fan of bringing it back. I would be a fan of bringing it back just because we can get a new king, which means that Corbin gets rid of this terrible gimmick. Cesaro and Jimmy Uso, they were having a perfectly fine match until Roman Reigns attacked Cesaro for the DQ. Jimmy was not happy about it. He said that he had the match in control. Roman always has to make it about himself. He went to leave and Roman chased after him and spoke. He spoke the truth when he said, look, nobody cares about these little insignificant matches. It's about the big money matches that I'm involved in. That's what people care about. That's what people pay to see. Roman ran in when he noticed that in the ring, Cesaro was beating up Jay. And he got beaten down too. And the show ended with Cesaro standing tall after laying out Jey Uso with the neutralizer. So Cesaro was made to look strong on this show, but pretty weak for a go-home show. Definitely not the best SmackDown this week. Which leads into tonight. Tonight is WrestleMania Backlash, or as us normal people call it, Backlash. We have Dolph Ziggler and Bobby Roode defending the SmackDown Tag Team titles against Rey Mysterio and Dominik. I think Rey and Dom as Tag Team Champions is the destination, but not tonight. I see this as the first of at least two matches between these two teams. I think Ziggler and Roode steal a win here. But when Rey and Dominik do win the belts, I think they're going to end up dropping them fairly quickly to the Usos. Damian Priest takes on The Miz in a lumberjack match. They're trying to build up Damian Priest, which they have to. They have no choice. They have no babyfaces. They have no top babyfaces left to challenge Bobby Lashley on that show. And some of the big names they do have, whether it's AJ, Orton, Riddle, they're involved in the tag team picture. So they have to build up somebody like a Damian Priest if they want somebody in a month or 2 months to be able to slot in there who's not named Braun Strowman or Drew McIntyre to challenge Bobby Lashley for the WWE Championship, assuming he is still the champion. But there is absolutely no reason for Damian Priest to take the loss here. Morrison probably plays a role in costing Miz the match, be it inadvertently or on purpose. Because it does seem we are heading for a Miz and Morrison split. Bianca Belair defends the SmackDown Women's Championship against Bayley. The build to this has been pretty, you know, paint-by-number stuff. But the match itself, I think, should be good. No chance that Belair drops the belt here, though. Bianca wins. And she resumes her program with Sasha Banks, who we could potentially see back on TV as early as tonight. Rhea Ripley defends the Raw Women's Championship against Asuka and Charlotte Flair in a triple threat match. You cannot bet against Charlotte in these matches. It would actually fit her character arc right now, which is that she gets what she wants. I am not foolish enough to bet against her, so I think Rhea's run comes to an abrupt halt, and then they make her chase to get it back, because Charlotte Flair is going to win the Raw Women's Championship. That is my prediction here in this match. Whether she pins Asuka or she makes her tap, new champion Charlotte Flair. Bobby Lashley defends his WWE Championship, also in a triple threat match against Drew McIntyre and Braun Strowman. I think Strowman is in this match to take the losing fall. I've given some thought to the idea that maybe they would put the belt on him. I wouldn't do that. I think he's in the match to take the loss. I don't think they want to beat Drew twice. There's no sense in taking the belt off Lashley yet. You know, as much as I've talked about there being no other babyfaces for Lashley to defend against, it's not as if they have a ton of heel challengers in laying in wait either, if Drew gets the belt back. But I think there's also a chance Jinder Mahal will cost Drew McIntyre the match, because I am sure it is a matter of when and not if they start a feud between the two of them, so Bobby Lashley is my pick to retain. And Roman Reigns defends the Universal Championship against Cesaro. It has been nice to see Cesaro getting the big push, including wins over Daniel Bryan and Seth Rollins. But we always knew this was temporary. I am under no illusion of there being a title change here. Roman Reigns is going to retain. I just wanted the man to have his moment, to get his match for one of the top titles, and now he's got one. But he will fall, the same way that Kevin Owens did, the same way that Daniel Bryan did, and the same way that Edge did. I think Jimmy Uso is up next to challenge Roman after this, and they'll build to the drama of, you know, what will his brother do when push comes to shove? Will Jay side with Jimmy, or will he help Roman Reigns beat his brother? Because they haven't really set anybody else up as the next challenger for Roman Reigns once we get past this pay-per-view, unless they go with Cesaro a second time, which I guess they could do. Right? They got three matches out of the Kevin Owens feud. They got two pay-per-view matches and a cage match on TV. So it is possible that this will not be the last time we see Cesaro challenging for the championship, but he will not win. Join me live on YouTube tonight, immediately after Backlash. You guys know the drill. I got you covered for the full recap. We'll talk about the show. We'll take your super chats. We'll have a good time. So hit that sub button on YouTube if you are not already subscribed. That way, as soon as I put the page up with the live chat, you should get the notification. If you don't, well, don't blame me. Blame YouTube. I get the occasional message, oh, I didn't get the notification. Well, that's a YouTube issue, unfortunately. But hopefully most of you do get the notifications. That's kind of the point. When you're a subscriber, you're supposed to be notified of these things. Hopefully that will be the case tonight. But I got to tell you about something that does work. Even if YouTube doesn't always work, this is something that I think a lot of you are going to enjoy. I had the chance to try my first meal with HelloFresh recently. You may have seen the photos I posted on Twitter the other day. The food was fantastic. So what is HelloFresh and what do you get? What you get are fresh, pre-measured ingredients and recipes delivered right to your door. It's easy, it's fun, it's affordable, and that is why it is America's number one meal kit. I am no master chef. The extent of my cooking prowess is probably cooking eggs for breakfast. And if you listen to the weekly Dynamite streams that I do, you would know that I'm usually eating cereal for dinner on Wednesdays. These recipes, though, they're easy to follow, quick to make. Even I can follow along because they have steps and pictures to guide you along the way. They also cut out the need for meal planning and grocery store trips so you can get dinner on the table, usually in 30 minutes or less. HelloFresh also offers convenient contact-free delivery right to your doorstep. It also offers the flexibility that you need with customizable orders each week. You can add extra protein or extra sides. You can change up the serving size when you're expecting guests, or you can just double up on your favorite recipes. If you need to change your delivery day or skip a week, no problem. Feeding the whole family has never been easier with larger box sizes for more servings and more savings, too. The other night, I cooked a honey thyme pork tenderloin with roasted potatoes and Brussels sprouts, enough to serve two, so that covered my brother and I. Oh boy. Chef Ramsay would have been proud. He would have been proud of me. Go to HelloFresh.com/Solomonster12 and use the code Solomonster12 for 12 free meals, including free shipping. That's HelloFresh.com/Solomonster12 and use code Solomonster12 for 12 free meals, including free shipping. Or HelloFresh, America's number one meal kit. NXT on Tuesday drew its lowest numbers since moving to Tuesdays with 697,000 viewers on USA Network. It was beaten out by the episode of Miz and Mrs. that aired after Raw on Monday, which did 784,000 viewers. Ouch. Beaten by Miz and Mrs. There is no positive way to spin that. Referee Drake Wirtz was back in the news. This is becoming an embarrassing weekly occurrence. This time he missed the NXT taping to attend a school board meeting arguing against the use of masks for children in schools. He was citing Bible verses. David Bixenspan on Twitter had the video. Wirtz argued that wearing masks in schools helps predators who wish to prey upon children, and that teachers would not be able to identify their own students if they were wearing masks. Look, he's free to believe in whatever he chooses, no matter how batshit crazy he sounds. And it's really sad because from what I know of his story, he was into a lot of really bad stuff. Yeah, he used to be a deathmatch wrestler, and he was into drugs and all kinds of shit. And by all accounts, he turned his life around. He used to be one of the feel-good stories down there at the Performance Center, became a referee. Now, it's just, every time I see a new story pop up about him, it's just sad to see. And the issue to me is him doing that Zoom call backstage at the PC a few weeks ago with an NXT logo on his shirt, ranting like a maniac. I'm sure the WWE does not want to be tied into this stuff in any way, and that is something they need to address with him directly if he's going to be doing that sort of thing. I know he was basically demoted from his role as head referee some time ago. Whether that was an official thing or not, I don't know. But he is no longer their lead official. That title now belongs to someone else. Some of the other NXT referees, whenever there is a new story about him, they just post these cryptic tweets and these emojis. It's just really embarrassing. And whatever he wants to do on his own time is his business, but if he's missing tapings of the show, or if he's going to be on a Zoom call spouting off shit backstage at the Performance Center wearing, you know, an NXT shirt or a hoodie or whatever it was, that's a whole different ball of wax. And in my opinion, the company is well within its rights to at least have a conversation with him and warn him about doing that in the future. And if not, then they're going to have to do something about that at some point. Now, TakeOver In Your House is coming back for a second year, June 13th, hosted by Todd Pettengill. I love it. Todd is great. Karrion Kross got a largely squash win over Austin Theory to open NXT this week. Still went longer than I thought it should have gone. This should have been Kross just destroying him in a couple of minutes at the most. Finn Balor came out. He said he wants his rematch for the NXT title, and Kross said he wants the same thing. So that match is going to take place not this week, but next. So they're not waiting for TakeOver to do the match, which is interesting, because there is no other obvious opponent for Kross after Balor. I mean, I guess there's Kyle O'Reilly. Maybe Adam Cole comes back, and they set up a four-way. Maybe they do a four-way match. Kross, Balor, Cole, and O'Reilly. And we end up getting a non-finish in the match next week against Balor. That's also, I think, very possible. I almost think it has to be a multi-man match in your house. Whatever the world title match is going to be, probably is going to be a multi-man. I thought the MSK win over Breezango was fun. You know, I got a kick out of the drop-down leapfrog spot with the referee trying to get out of the way of the action. That was unexpected. MSK picked up the win. All four men shook hands after, but Fandango looked frustrated by the loss. That is something to watch. Pete Dunne was out with Oney Lorcan at his side looking for competition, and he issued an open challenge. And my ears immediately perked up, because with TakeOver coming up, wouldn't it be something if a certain free agent were to show up to accept his challenge to a match? Daniel Bryan against Pete Dunne. See, that would be must-see. More likely, though, now that I've teased you, more likely it will be Kyle O'Reilly. On this show, it was Leon Ruff who answered the challenge, even after William Regal had refused to allow him to compete. Earlier in the night, there was a segment between the two. And this is because Regal said after his loss to Swerve Scott the week before in that False Count Anywhere match, he could not, in good conscience, put him in a match. Leon Ruff was not happy about that, so he came out here and he answered the open challenge, and Vic Joseph on commentary said, well, there's nothing that Commissioner Regal can do about it. And I just thought to myself, since when? He's the fucking general manager. Not the commissioner. He's the GM. He's the fucking general manager of NXT. He can do whatever he wants. Where is Vic Joseph getting this information from? What rule in the rule book says that, well, if it's an open challenge, then you can, it pretty much supersedes everything else. It ended with a ref stoppage. Pete Dunne snapped his fingers after the match. See, he should have listened to Regal and stayed in the fucking back. And his fingers wouldn't be broken. Raquel Gonzalez retained her NXT Women's Championship over Mercedes Martinez. I don't know if she was just selling exhaustion or what, but Martinez looked like she was moving through quicksand late in the match, and there were a few clunky spots where the two of them just did not click at all. I still enjoyed it, you know, overall. It was Gonzalez's first real test since becoming champion. It was a hard-fought win. Wasn't always pretty, but it was a hard-fought win. I was surprised they didn't end the show with this, but the Cruiserweight title match, it was the better of the two matches, so things worked out okay in the end. One of the highlights of the show was Isaiah Swerve Scott and the introduction of his new crew, which they are calling Hit Row, which consists of Swerve, AJ Francis, who is now going by the name Top Dollar, Ashanti The Adonis, and Brianna Brandy, going by the name B-Fab, who has been signed for 2 years now. I thought this was great. I was a big fan of this segment. Swerve in the ring was sitting in a fancy chair that Top Dollar brought into the ring. It's like he was sitting in his recording studio. He said he was tired of being what people wanted him to be and being able to be himself, or not being able, I should say, to be himself. So he's going to be himself from now on. He said he went and got people who think the way that he does. And AJ Francis rapped about being in the NFL and appearing on A&E. Ashanti got to speak. B-Fab got to speak. And at the end, they told us, if you didn't know, now you know. And they flashed their hand gesture to the camera. So at long last, they're doing something meaningful with Shane Strickland. I am digging the new stable. It's going to take some getting used to, though, seeing AJ Francis like this when on the Most Wanted Treasure show on A&E, he's like this giant geek negotiating $2,500 deals with wrestling fans holding a pair of tights hostage in their basement that Sergeant Slaughter wore in 1991. It's basically what he does. Going to have to sweeten the pot. If you want the Sarge's undies, you got to make that deal a little bit sweeter for me. $2,500 just isn't enough. You give me $3,500 and an autograph, and then we'll talk. Oh, well, all right. I got to check with Triple H on that, though. The show is getting ridiculous. I mean, I've been watching the Treasure show. It's getting ridiculous. We had another Cameron Grimes segment with the Million Dollar Man. This time it took place at an outdoor auction for this palatial estate somewhere down in Florida. Every time Grimes would place a bid, he was outbid by a mystery man, who of course was Ted DiBiase, who ended up spending $20 million on a home that was definitely not worth anywhere close to $20 million. DiBiase told him, everybody's got a price for the Million Dollar Man, and you're no Million Dollar Man. Grimes screamed into the heavens. We know this isn't leading to a match between the two of them, but I don't know. I mean, would they make DiBiase his manager? I mean, DiBiase as a manager never really worked out 25 years ago. I don't know why this would be any different. It definitely didn't work out for the ringmaster. Whatever happened to that guy anyway? I don't know. I'd like an update on the whereabouts of the ringmaster. They should do a Where Are They Now feature and tell us where he is. Kevin emailed me, shout out to Kevin, with a thought on the payoff to all this, which I thought was clever. What if DiBiase brings back IRS and we find out that Cameron Grimes did not pay taxes on any of the money that he came into? And he winds up going broke. That could work. We'll find out, because they've announced DiBiase is going to be appearing live at the COVID Coliseum this Tuesday, live in person. Kyle O'Reilly beat Oney Lorcan, hence why I am sure that we are going to get O'Reilly and Dunn at In Your House and not Daniel Bryan. Kyle got the win with his flying knee drop finish. Dunn and Lorcan beat him down until Bobby Fish returned from his latest injury. I've lost count of how many injuries it's been. He was out in street clothes to make the save for his partner, or now ex-partner, I guess. Kyle said it was good to see him back, but he's doing his own thing now. Fish said, I know that. I've got my own scores to settle. He didn't say with who. I'll see you when I see you. That is how they left things. So they're still friendly with one another, but you know that probably won't last very long. And in the main event, Kushida beat Santos Escobar 2-1 to retain his NXT Cruiserweight Championship. Legado del Fantasma tried to get involved early, but MSK attacked them, and both teams ended up being ejected by the referee. Escobar won the first fall with the Phantom Driver. Kushida followed seconds later with a cross arm breaker for the tap out, so they were tied at one fall apiece. What followed was excellent stuff. Kushida escaped a second attempt at a Phantom Driver, got a near fall. He had a top rope Spanish fly to Escobar, transitioned into the hoverboard lock. Escobar managed to get to the bottom rope for the break. And Kushida won the match with a bridging Northern Lights suplex where he had Escobar's arms trapped underneath him and he couldn't kick out. So Kushida wins 2-1. Clocked this at around 18 minutes of what I thought was a terrific match. Escobar could be such a star. If only I trusted them to do something with him on the big stage, I really wish I did. I really wish. I hate that I have to be so cynical about it, but I have no choice. Because time and time again, they have let me down. Even look what they're doing with Rhea Ripley. Rhea Ripley is the Raw Women's Champion, right? Exactly where she should be. Why is it that when I watch Raw, especially when they have her cutting promos now, everything that I liked about Rhea Ripley in NXT is slowly being stripped away on Monday Night Raw. She's exactly where she should be. Top of the women's division on the Raw brand. And yet I watch the show and every single week I seem to be losing more interest in her. This is what happens when these people get called up. In a lot of cases. So as much as I want to sit here and tell you, oh, I have these great ideas and these great plans for Santos Escobar if he goes to Raw or if he goes to SmackDown, all the things they could do with him and the way they could build him up, and one day he could be one of the top five or six names on either of those brands. Do I trust that they'll do right by him? No. I don't. But what works to his advantage, probably with Vince McMahon, is the fact that he can speak English perfectly fine. He can speak Spanish fluently. He can speak English fluently. There is no language barrier with him the way that you might say there is kind of with Nakamura, or that there is with some of the luchadors they have up there, or even Asuka, who they have rant and rave like a clown every week on television. They put a little red nose on her face the way that they have her acting on TV. Escobar doesn't have that issue. So I think that should work to his advantage. But they've really been trying to make the Cruiserweight title feel special on this show. I think this is the second time now he's been featured in the main event spot. Apparently it's not much of a ratings draw. So I don't know how many more Cruiserweight main events they're going to give us. But I do like the added emphasis, at least, on that championship. Now this Tuesday, Zoe Stark has a rematch with Toni Storm. And Bronson Reed gets Johnny Gargano in a cage for the North American title. I would hope that with a cage match promoted, they could do better than 697,000 viewers. But I think this week might be the series, or not the series, but the season finale of Miz and Mrs. So it is very possible that it actually may beat NXT for the second week in a row. Now in 2 weeks, Frankie Monet has what they're calling her world premiere, which I assume is her in-ring debut. And Finn Balor will challenge Karrion Kross for the NXT Championship.
History has been made here!
This week in wrestling history, 36 years ago this week on May 10th, 1985, WWE taped the debut episode of Saturday Night's Main Event from the Nassau Coliseum in Long Island, New York, which aired on NBC the next night with an 8.8 television rating. Were more than 10 million viewers in what was normally the time slot for Saturday Night Live. WWE had gone mainstream with the rock and wrestling stuff in the first WrestleMania 2 months earlier, so getting onto network television was a huge deal. It was a big part of Vince McMahon's national expansion, led by Hulk Hogan, who beat Cowboy Bob Orton by DQ on this show and had Mr. T in his corner. Wendy Richter beat the Fabulous Moolah to retain her women's title, and Junkyard Dog beat Pete Doherty. JYD had his mother Bertha in his corner in this celebration of Mother's Day. This was Mother's Day weekend. and the two of them danced in the ring when the match was over. Cyndi Lauper was on the show as well, and they aired the premiere of her new music video for the song The Goonies Are Good Enough, which featured a bunch of wrestler cameos from Captain Lou Albano, Classy Freddie Blassie, Rowdy Roddy Piper, The Iron Sheik, Nikolai Volkoff, and Moolah. The Goonies were the shit. It's my favorite movie as a kid. I loved everything about Saturday night's main event. Always felt like such a big deal. You put the Goonies together with Saturday night's main event, got yourself a winning combo. The original theme song, by the way, is still the best. Not that I actually liked the second version of the Saturday night's main event music, but nothing's going to beat Obsession by Animotion. And back then they used a Phil Collins song for the outro. 33 years ago this week on May 11th, 1988, WWE ran one of their marathon tapings that they used to run back then, but this one may have been the longest. In Rochester, Minnesota, 4 episodes of Wrestling Challenge they taped. When you throw in the dark matches that night, there was an unbelievable total of 31 matches. I mean, that's like 2 episodes of AEW Dark. The longest of which, on the Challenge tapings, the longest match of which, I don't have the times on the dark matches, but for the TV matches, it was a Coco Beware match against Rick Renslow, which aired on June 5th. That ran a whopping 3 minutes and 50 seconds. 26 years ago this week, on May 14th, 1995, WWE presented its first ever In Your House pay-per-view from Syracuse, New York, which was launched as a series of 2-hour pay-per-view shows at a reduced price point of $14.95. Before this, we had the Big Four, right? Royal Rumble, WrestleMania, SummerSlam, Survivor Series. The Big Four became the Big Five in 1993 when they added the King of the Ring. Then In Your House followed a couple of years later. The In Your House shows opened the door for them to start doing monthly pay-per-views. And the big hook for the inaugural show was that they would be giving away an actual house in Orlando to one lucky winner, which turned out to be an 11-year-old kid named Matt Pompaselli of Henderson, Nevada. WWE.com caught up with young Matt, I guess now not so young Matt, in 2012 to find out if he was still living in the house. As it turns out, the family sold the house 6 months after he won it. Yeah, I'll bet they did. They probably didn't want to pay the taxes on that thing. I don't blame him. He said they had just moved from New York to Las Vegas, and instead of moving again to Florida, they opted to sell it, bank the money for his college fund. Flipped his first house at age 11. It's very impressive. He says it sold for more than $175,000, which wouldn't even buy you the basement of an apartment or a house here in New York. Probably a lot of other places, for that matter. He said the night of the show, when Todd Pettengill dialed the phone number, they dialed the wrong number initially, so their phone didn't ring, but then they tried again and his dad answered the phone. Bret Hart pulled double duty on the show, wrestling Hakushi in the opener. Very good match. And then Jerry Lawler later in the show, who won with an assist from Hakushi and his manager Shinja. Razor Ramon beat Jeff Jarrett and the Roadie in a handicap match, and while being beaten down after, a man that they identified only as a fan ran in to make the save. That man was the debuting Savio Vega, who had been wrestling for them before as Quang. Diesel beat Psycho Sid by disqualification to retain the WWF title when Tatanka interfered and Bam Bam Bigelow made the save, which set up a tag team match for the King of the Ring the following month. Pettengill, by the way, is coming back for the second straight year to host the NXT In Your House event next month on June 13th. I think they should fly Matt Pompaselli down for the show. It's too bad he doesn't still own the house. I think that segment they did on NXT this week where they auctioned off that house with Cameron Grimes, they could have saved that for a takeover. And instead you have Grimes offer to buy the house from the kid and then Ted DiBiase outbids him for it. It was a squandered opportunity. The next night, at the Raw taping in Binghamton, New York, Triple H made his Monday Night Raw in-ring debut against John Crystal. winning with his version of a diamond cutter or RKO, I guess depending on how old you are, which was a move that was sometimes they referred to on television in the early days of Triple H as a, this is what they called it, pedigree pandemonium. One person who took note of this was Diamond Dallas Page, who had already started getting the move over in WCW. He credits Johnny Ace and William Regal for helping him come up with it. This is what he told Sports Illustrated in 2017 about getting Triple H to stop using the move. Said, I'll tell you a great story about Triple H. He was there that day that Johnny Laurinaitis and I were working on it. He was still there in WCW for another 3 or 4 months. Now I'm getting that move over. One night on Raw, because I watched everything they had, he hit a diamond cutter out of nowhere and beat somebody. And I thought, oh no, if he does it, it's going to sort of dilute what I'm doing. So I call him. One of the very few times he answered his phone. He's like, hey D, what's up, man? I'm like, I got a favor, bro. He goes, sure, what do you need? I go, no, no, don't say that. I got no right to ask you this favor. Because Bret Hart had the sharpshooter and Sting had the scorpion deathlock, same move. I said, you know, I saw you did a diamond cutter the other night. I think your pedigree's amazing. It's a great finish, but I'm just starting to get that diamond cutter over, bro. Was he Vince Russo? I would really appreciate it if you wouldn't do it anymore. Sure, D. He never did it again. And he didn't have to do that. And so ended the short run of pedigree pandemonium in WWE, which he traded in for the double underhook facebuster that he has used ever since. 24 years ago this week, featured a memorable episode of Raw is War on May 12, 1997, a show where Paul Bearer threatened to reveal a shocking secret about The Undertaker that he vowed to keep while standing over the gravesite of Undertaker's parents. I wonder what that could have been. Farouk asked Vince McMahon, when was the last time a black man won the WWF title? He said, never, because the white man doesn't feel the black man is worthy of holding the gold. McMahon said it has nothing to do with being black, and Farouk called Undertaker the white savior. Imagine thinking Undertaker would be called the White Savior when he first debuted with that gimmick in 1990. Had he debuted as the White Savior, I don't think he would have enjoyed the same level of success. ECW's own Rob Van Dam made his Raw debut with Jerry Lawler dubbing him Mr. Monday Night and cutting an anti-ECW promo before telling RVD to take care of this little Jon Bon Jovi wannabe across the ring from him. That Jon Bon Jovi wannabe was a young man named Jeff Hardy. RVD got some chance of "you sold out" from some fans in the audience, which was very amusing given that these fans paid to attend a WWE show. And they're chanting, "you sold out" at the ECW guy for coming to WWE. And to close out the show, we had Bret Hart in a wheelchair recovering from a knee scope, calling Shawn Michaels out to the ring to tell him how much he hates his guts. I love how Bret always used to call Shawn Michaels by his full name. That's kind of like what they do today in WWE, because they think everybody's a first-time viewer. You never know who's tuning into the show, so you gotta say their full name. Hey, look, it's Vince McMahon. Hey, here's my son, Shane McMahon. Here's my daughter, Stephanie McMahon. Maybe in his old age, he did that just to kind of train his brain in case he started to forget his own children. That's one of my theories about that. But all the time, Bret would be Shawn Michaels, boy toy, like always. Go back and watch those promos in 97. Always Shawn Michaels, boy toy. So Bret's sitting in his chair. He's healing up on all the American scum in the audience. He said Michaels didn't have the guts to face him at WrestleMania 13. He talked about Michaels posing for girly magazines and getting his navel pierced. He ranted on for so long they ran out of time before the big payoff and they went off the air. And the following week they showed a replay of what we missed, which was Bret rising from his chair and Shawn Michaels super kicking him over the chair. The Hart Foundation ran out to beat down Michaels until Stone Cold Steve Austin made the save. This would lead to one of the greatest matches in Raw history. A few weeks later for the tag team titles, Michaels was said to be furious that Bret went on for so long they had to end the show before he got his revenge with the kick. He felt that Bret purposely sabotaged him. Bruce Pritchard has said that the cameramen at ringside were giving cues to Bret, you know, to kind of wrap things up. Bret claims he simply didn't see them. Not that he did it on purpose. But this set the stage for all the problems. I mean, this wasn't the only thing, but this is one of the things that set the stage for all the problems that were yet to come between these two men. 23 years ago this week, on May 14th, 1998, Seinfeld aired its series finale on NBC to the tune of 76 million viewers, and ECW presented It Ain't Seinfeld. From the Elks Lodge in Queens, New York. It was on this night that Taz introduced his new FTW title for the first time, which was an old television title they gave to him, painted orange, to have him defend while ECW champion Shane Douglas was out nursing an injury, which allowed them to build to a match between the two of them, which they did in January, a guilty as charged, where Taz, for the first time, won the world title. 22 years ago this week, on May 10th, 1999, with WCW Monday Nitro preempted by the NBA playoffs, Monday Night Raw set its all-time ratings record on USA Network with an absolutely ridiculous 8.1 Nielsen rating. I still have a newspaper clipping about this from the New York Daily News. The rating was so big it made headlines in newspapers around the country. 8.1 rating and a 12 share for a total of around 9.2 million viewers. They slaughtered both NBA games that night, which was a 1.2 rating and a 1.4 rating respectively. The show peaked with a 9.1 for the overrun, topping 10 million viewers for a main event of Stone Cold, The Rock, and Vince McMahon against The Undertaker, Triple H, and Shane McMahon. Believe Shawn Michaels may have been the guest referee. But that by far makes it the most watched wrestling match in the history of cable television. A record that I don't really see ever falling. I mean, now with the way that television is so fragmented and you have streaming and all these different channels now that you didn't have back in 99, I don't see how that's ever going to be topped. Speaking of Michaels, he was the commissioner at the time. Commissioner Shawn Michaels was busy on this show playing matchmaker, pitting the Acolytes, Farouk and Bradshaw, against each other, the Mean Street Posse against Pat Patterson and Gerald Briscoe, Paul Bearer against the Big Show, and poor Paul Bearer, he promptly passed out when the match was announced. It's actually one of the funniest moments I can remember from that show. He's in the ring. Obviously, he's scared to death. He doesn't want to wrestle Big Show. He's kind of cowering in the corner. He's just... And Paul Bearer with that accent, he's going, "I'm not a wrestler!" And he's like, "I'm not a wrestler!" Well, tough shit. You got your ass kicked by the Big Show. Ken Shamrock in China went to a no contest, and Debra beat Sable in an evening gown match to win the WWE Women's Championship after Sable tore off Debra's clothes, which normally would mean Sable would be announced as the winner. But Shawn Michaels said, as far as he's concerned, the person who loses their clothes should be the winner. And he awarded the title to Debra. And as you might imagine, there is a story behind this. Why would they do this? This is very dumb. There was a lot of drama going on behind the scenes with Sable at that time. From the WWE side, they would claim that she was becoming increasingly difficult to deal with in the months prior, not wanting to wrestle, even though she was the women's champion. But she felt she wasn't a trained wrestler, and she was afraid of getting hurt. But Sable was legitimately one of the hottest stars in the company at the time, probably second only to Steve Austin. I don't know where The Rock would have been at that point. Popularity-wise, I feel like He wasn't even quite at his peak then. Or but you could say Austin Rock Sable, top three. I don't think that's far-fetched at all. Anybody who was a fan back then knows full well how popular she was. And her segments on TV reflected that. Her segments on TV, she was a ratings mover. The Playboy magazines, which I think at that time were the highest selling of all time. So she got away with a lot because of that. If it was anybody else, they would have buried the shit out of him. But here, they came up with this finish that allowed her to not get physical while dropping the title. Now, per the June 14th, 1999 issue of the Wrestling Observer, leading up to this match, Sable suggested losing the title, but not on television, which Vince McMahon outright refused. He said, if she didn't show for this edition of Raw to drop the belt, she would be breaching her contract. So she brought her lawyers with her to the show, and she wrote her own terms for dropping the title, which is how we got this dumb finish to this match with Deborah. She presented a handwritten contract that night, which her and WWE both agreed to before the show, and Meltzer reprinted this contract as follows. Now, how he got possession of this contract is not explained, but this is what it said. Notwithstanding any, and that's a Vince McMahon word, by the way. Totally a Vince McMahon word. Notwithstanding any agreement between us, and because we disagree about the fashion I would lose my belt, and because of my concerns of humiliation and safety, it is agreed that I appear tonight solely upon your contractual assurances that I will not lose my gown nor wrestle, and that the girl with whom I am interfacing, it's an interesting way of putting it, agrees with her role. My appearance in Manchester shall be no more than parading in the ring and shall not include wrestling. I agree to make a scheduled personal appearance outside the ring. Otherwise, I will have complete hiatus from WWF until May 23rd, at which time we hope to have our contractual concerns resolved. Until such time, neither I nor the WWF, its employees or subcontractors, shall speak disparagingly about the other, scripted or unscripted. After this, WWE pulled all of her merch, canceled all of her promotional appearances. 6 days later, on her final night with the company in Manchester, somebody either defecated in it or otherwise placed feces in her bag, which Sean Waltman later admitted to doing. Well, I appreciate his honesty, if nothing else. A few weeks later, she slapped the company with a $140 million lawsuit, although she later reduced that number, citing allegations of sexual harassment and unsafe working conditions. And on July 22nd, both sides settled out of court, and the terms were never disclosed, although she did come back to the company, because they always do. They always come back. She was no different. 4 years later, she had a brief run in 2003, but Sable did eventually come back to WWE. 21 years ago, on the May 15, 2000 episode of Raw is War, during a match between the Godfather and Crash Holly for the Hardcore Championship, D'Lo Brown ran down to the ring to join in and try to win the title. And when Godfather took him out over the top rope, one of Godfather's hoes scurried into the ring and covered Crash to win the hardcore title, which forced a very confused Lillian Garcia to announce in a legendary Raw moment, the winner and new hardcore champion, one of Godfather's hoes. But her run would only last 12 seconds before Crash rolled her up to win the belt back. See, I like a woman who knows what she wants and takes initiative. There should be a Hall of Fame induction in that woman's future. At least in the legacy wing. She later had a brief stint in TNA and was married to Al Snow for several years. 20 years ago this week, on May 10th, 2001, WWE and NBC jointly pulled the plug on the XFL. In a press release, Vince McMahon stated, while we believe that it is an extraordinary accomplishment to have created a new professional football league in what amounts to less than a year's time, We feel that it is in the best interest of our shareholders and our partners to discontinue the XFL. They started out hot, over 14 million viewers for the first game, but it was a quick decline after that. A March 21st column in the Chicago Tribune reported that NBC's latest broadcast did the lowest rating ever for a primetime program on one of the four major networks, beating out previous lows set by the Jean-Claude Van Damme movie Time Cop and the movie Alice in Wonderland. WWE and NBC each ended up losing around $35 or so million apiece on the league, but that did not stop Vince McMahon from trying again last year. And that didn't end too well for him either. We'll see if The Rock has better luck when he tries to relaunch the XFL himself next year. 19 years ago this week, on May 16th, 2002, Shoichi Arai, the promoter who took over for Atsushi Onita when he retired in 1995 as the head of FMW Wrestling, was found dead, hanging from his necktie in a park in Tokyo. He was only 35 years old. He started out as an assistant backstage in FMW, and he rose through the ranks to become the ring announcer and eventually the CEO when Onita stepped away. He cut out much of the extreme violence. He marketed FMW to a more mainstream audience. Basically, he tried to WWE-ize it, but interest waned, and a career-ending injury to Hayabusa, who he was building the promotion around as its next really big star until he was paralyzed in the ring, ultimately led to the company's downfall, and they declared bankruptcy in February of 2002. FMW was $3 million in debt at the time, with another $1 million that Arai owed to the Yakuza, which is never a good thing. His wife left him. He went into hiding. He had started writing a book about running FMW, dishing some dirt on Onita as a womanizer and other people in the organization, with the hope that he would make enough money to pay off the debt. Some of those chapters, by the way, they are available online if you search for them. But he felt the walls closing in on him. He decided to end his life. He spoke to Hayabusa on the phone. He explained to him what he planned to do. I'm going to kill myself so my ex-wife, and I guess they had a child together, would get enough insurance money to pay off the debt. That was his plan. And Hayabusa begged him, don't do it. Don't kill yourself. There's other ways. We can come up with a better way to get the money. But it was to no avail. And on the morning of May 16th, Arai walked to Mizumoto Park wearing a business suit and hung himself with his tie. He was found by a jogger. His family did end up collecting on his insurance policy, but unfortunately, it still was not enough to pay back the Yakuza. And they continued to make payments for many years after that. 17 years ago this week, on May 11th, 2004, Earthquake John Tenta publicly announced his retirement from wrestling after being diagnosed with advanced bladder cancer. He says, "This is Earthquake John Tenta sending you some news about myself. I have read the rumors on some sites that I am to be in an ABC pilot. That is not true. It is either someone's idea of a joke or a site just making stuff up. Surely, though, there are other people more noteworthy than myself. The truth is, I am at home, having been recently diagnosed with advanced bladder cancer. I go through testing this week with treatment starting shortly after. This is not a sympathy plea, as I do not believe I will go out this way. I simply now must admit my dream that came true. A boy becoming a pro wrestler is now over. It was a great ride, and I thank all of my fans for their support throughout the years. My last WWE match was a dark match against one of my students in Orlando, Florida. My last wrestling match was last year in Japan with All Japan Pro Wrestling, the company I made my pro debut with. A fitting ending, if I do say so myself. I have to make a special thank you to Vince McMahon for my Earthquake days and putting myself on top of the world during my battles with Hulk Hogan. I will beat my illness and live on with my memories and watch as my children's dreams come true. God bless all. And thank you once again for helping to make my dreams come true. Signed, John Tenta. P.S. I have a thread on a forum at wrestlecrap.com if anyone wants to leave a message for me, but please understand I cannot answer all of them. And he told WrestleCrap, I have a large tumor on my bladder blocking my left kidney from functioning properly. That is the bad news. The good news is that I will never give up my hope of beating this. I have too much to live for. And he talked about wanting to be at his daughter's wedding and see his son play Major League Baseball. I used to be a lurker and the occasional poster on those WrestleCrap forums, and I would see Tenta posting there occasionally. I remember they actually set up an entire forum for him. Forum. that sounded weird. They set up a forum for Earthquake under the name John Tenta. That's what I meant. But he was only given a 20% chance of survival, and that's if treatment worked. During a November 2005 interview on WrestleCrap Radio, he announced his recent radiation treatment had no effect on the tumor and his cancer had spread to his lungs. He passed away the following June, 2 weeks shy of his 43rd birthday. He looked 43 when he wrestled Hogan, and that was in 90. It's hard to believe he was only in his late 20s when he debuted in WWE. He always looked older than he was. 5 days later, on May 16th, 2004, Eddie Guerrero wrestled John Bradshaw Layfield in one of the bloodiest matches in WWE history at Judgment Day. Eddie had beaten Brock Lesnar to become WWE champion, then he beat Kurt Angle, and he needed a new opponent, but they were fresh out of heels on SmackDown, which led to a sudden character transformation for Bradshaw, who went from beer-drinking barroom brawler to J.R. Ewing cowboy basically overnight. It's like they flipped a switch. It was a tough sell, I mean, for a lot of people, to buy him as a challenger for the WWE Championship, but hey, enter Eddie Guerrero. Eddie was friends with him. He wanted to do what he could to help get JBL over. Eddie was even one of his groomsmen at his wedding. This was all around the time they did the segment on SmackDown where JBL went to the Mexican border to kick out a bunch of illegals. They did an angle at a house show with Eddie's mother where she pretended to have a heart attack. Now, if you believe Bruce Pritchard, she ended up having a legitimate heart scare where they thought she really was having a heart attack and they had an ambulance take her to the hospital after the angle was over. But Pritchard is the only person I've ever heard say this. I don't know if Eddie addressed it in his book or not. You take some of the things that he says with a grain of salt, especially because, you know, Pritchard says the heart attack angle was his idea. And yet JBL was on the After the Bell podcast with Corey Graves, and he said the idea came from Eddie and Chavo. So again, it really just depends on who you believe. During their pay-per-view match, JBL destroyed Eddie with a disgusting chair shot to the head outside the ring. It sounded like a shotgun blast. Eddie bladed, but he hit an artery, cut himself too deep. He came up bleeding a gusher. The crowd gasped when they showed him on the Titantron. You could just hear them. You could hear the reaction. Once they got back in the ring mat was drenched in blood, puddles of blood everywhere like a crime scene. Eddie was disqualified after hitting JBL in the head with the belt. After the show went off the air, Eddie went into shock from all the blood loss. He collapsed in the ring, had to be helped to the back, rushed to the hospital by ambulance. It took 16 stitches to close the wound on his head. And according to the May 24th issue of The Observer, at the hospital, they suggested he get a blood transfusion. And Eddie said no. He turned him down. 15 years ago this week, on May 15th, 2006, Mick Foley confronted his mentor, fellow WWE Hall of Famer Terry Funk, in the ring on Monday Night Raw. This was the week after Foley turned heel, joining his old rival Edge in an attack on Tommy Dreamer, which was to build to a Foley and Edge against Funk and Dreamer tag match at the second ECW One Night Stand pay-per-view. Foley told Funk that at WrestleMania 22, he and Edge had the greatest hardcore match ever, and he wasn't about to let those second-rate ECW scumbags into our house. He said he would defend three things with his life. His wife, his kids, and his legacy. He told Funk that in 2003, when WWE did the Legend Ceremony on Raw when they retired the Hardcore title and presented it to him, Funk skipped the show because he wanted more money to appear. Foley said, "One day I'm going to get that call telling me that the Funker is gone. And when that happens, he'll say, it's going to take a lot of money to get me out to a dump like West Texas." But Foley said he'd fly down there on his own dime just to spit on Terry Funk's grave. That then led to the best part of this entire segment. Funk was trying to goad Foley into hitting him, but Foley wouldn't take the bait. He insulted Mick. He said that if he had a head like his, he'd have it circumcised. No reaction from Foley. He said Mick's wife is a whore. No reaction from Foley. He called Mick's kids bastards. No reaction from Foley. Finally, Funk says, "The WWE sucks." And I'm trying to do my best Terry Funk, that's awful. But that's kind of how he said it. "The WWE sucks." And that was just too much for Mick Foley to bear. He nailed Funk, who fought back, but Edge and Lita came out and the numbers game was too much for Terry Funk. I thought that part was brilliant. It was such a great way for Foley to get heat on himself. The man is insulting his family. He calls his wife a whore. His kids are bastards. But saying the WWE sucks? Now you've crossed the line. 9 years ago this week on May 12th, 2012, Ring of Honor hosted its Border Wars Eye pay-per-view from the Ted Reeve Arena in Toronto. This was an important show for the company after their Eye pay-per-view disaster. Over WrestleMania weekend, they parted ways with Go Fight Live. They took their production in-house. So this was make or break for the company. But they did not anticipate the number of people that would be logging onto their server all at once. I don't know why they wouldn't have expected this, but they didn't. And it went down right before the show began. Jim Cornette was among those who tried and failed to watch the show from home. Cornette was working for ROH at the time, but he has a record of assaults from fighting with fans over the years, going back to his days as a manager for the Midnight Express. I mean, he's been to Canada since then, but for whatever reason, he was... You know, this one time he tried to get in with his wife while he was working for Ring of Honor. He was denied entry into the country. I don't know if this was the time that this happened, but they wouldn't let him into the country. So he tried to watch it from home. It didn't work out. But in the main event, Kevin Steen won his first ROH world title, defeating Davey Richards, celebrating in the ring after with Steve Corino and Jimmy Jacobs. 2 years later, to the day, WWE called to offer him a contract, and Kevin Owens would soon be born. And finally, 1 year ago this week, on May 10th, 2020, WWE aired its Money in the Bank pay-per-view, with most of the card airing live from the Empty Performance Center in Orlando, but with cut-ins to both the men's and women's Money in the Bank ladder matches filmed cinematically for the first time ever, taped back on April 15th from Titan Tower in Stamford, Connecticut. Asuka won the briefcase for the ladies. Otis won the briefcase for the men in a match where Daniel Bryan and AJ Styles fought into Vince McMahon's office with him in it. And Rey Mysterio and Aleister Black were each thrown off the roof to their doom. They were later reanimated, I guess. And the next night on Raw, Asuka opened her briefcase to find the Raw Women's Championship inside, which she won unknowingly by virtue of her winning Money in the Bank, because Becky Lynch announced that she was pregnant and she would be leaving to go become a mom. And that division has sorely missed her presence. That is for sure. And that is this week in wrestling history. Email your questions to me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. I didn't get to them this week, but I've been trying to answer some of them directly. Others I'm saving for upcoming Q&A, so that's the place to send all questions, inquiries, comments. Follow me on Twitter, @solomonster, especially tonight during Backlash, and join me live on YouTube as soon as the pay-per-view goes off the air. Just type in Solomonster Sounds Off on YouTube. You'll find the official channel. And as soon as the event is over tonight, we'll go live on YouTube, review the entire event, take your super chats, who knows what else. It's always a good time. And, of course, every Wednesday night, don't forget I'm live on YouTube talking AEW Dynamite. This week will be no exception. Next Sunday is episode 705 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off, and I thank you so very much for all of your support. 700 episodes strong and already on the march to 800. All because of your support. It means a lot. So until then, be well, stay safe, and I will see you tonight after Backlash on YouTube. Until then, take care, guys.
The Sala Monster Sounds Off.
The great Kali. When I think back to all those Kali moments, I mean, we've got the, well, you know, there was the time that he, who can forget that great, you know, how about I just share a story? Big Show sees Kali walk in. He says, "Hey, motherfucker, why do you keep stealing my spots? That's bullshit. You can't even do any of it properly anyway because you're the fucking shits."
The Sala Monster Sounds Off, available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesalamonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow the Sala Monster on Twitter @SalaMonster.
Sala Monster.
Solo Monsters.
Put that cigarette out.
Sala Monster Sounds Off.